Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Buddhist Studies. I'm Connie Kasser, your host for today's show, and today we're going to be talking with Dr. Ruth Gamble about her book, Reincarnation in Tibetan Buddhism, The Third Karmapa and the Invention of a Tradition, published by Oxford University Press. Dr. Gamble is currently the David Myers Research Fellow in the Department of Archaeology and History at La Trobe University. Ruth, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you going?
Great. Thanks for being here. I'd like to start off, as we usually do in our New Books podcast, just by asking you to talk a little bit about yourself and your background. Where are you from? What's your education background? And how did you come to study the things that you study?
I have what you'd call a non-linear background story, I think is the best way to put it. I grew up in the north of Australia, and my first job was as a journalist. I studied journalism. And then I got a job working for American television, actually, in Japan at the Olympics, and decided I liked snowboarding better than journalism. And then I went snowboarding, and then I got bored of snowboarding and thought I'd go and check out the Himalayas because, you know, snow. And when I was there, I got interested in Tibetan language as well as interested in Tibetan Buddhism, and I did an interpreter's program in Dharamsala, learned Tibetan, and then moved back to Australia and worked as an interpreter for a Tibetan Geshe. And then while I was doing that, I did another degree in Asian studies. And then I went to graduate school and completed a PhD at the Australian National University in Canberra, Australia.
Wow.
And yeah, it's not normal.
So TV to snowboarding to the Himalayas to Tibetan stuff, and then you got a few degrees.
Yes. I have it's a nonlinear story, and I have a diverse background to bring to the research that I do.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, how did this book, Reincarnation in Tibetan Buddhism, come about? Where did this come from?
It's a result of my PhD research, but there's kind of a interesting story to that as well. I had started off thinking that I was going to write a thesis on Milarepa, Milarepa's life story and his poem. And then I found someone else had already done that. So I had a few gins. And then gin and tonics, and then tried to think of something else to do. And the next day, someone handed me a disc with Rangjun Dorji's Sungbum on it. And I thought, maybe he has songs. So I went through and found a massive collection of his gur, or his songs of experience. And I started working on those songs. And then in the process of trying to figure out where the songs fitted into the world, I realized that there was two autobiographies in the collected works as well. So then I started investigating them, and they were really fascinating. So I found that the combination of the songs, which are really extemporaneous, and he tells you exactly how he's feeling, as well as this kind of constructed narrative of himself together, gave me a really interesting insight into his world. into the third Kamapa's world.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, and so this, yeah. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
And then the idea of how you become a reincarnate and the construction of that identity and therefore that tradition, because he was the first third, if that makes sense, was a dominant theme or a predominant theme in all of his writing. Yeah.
Okay. So this came out of your PhD thesis, and it really kind of originated in your interest in looking at Rangjung Dorje's writings, and then kind of expanded beyond that to look at the broader kind of context.
Yeah, the broader context for how his writing was situated, particularly first his songs or his poems, and then his life story, and then how that was situated, how that reflected his identity and the historical context in which they were written. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So for folks who haven't read the book, which I loved this book. I really loved this book. So I hope that everybody listening will go and buy this book and read it, because I loved this book. I really did. But for folks who don't know about Rangjung Dorje, could you just explain a bit about who he was and why he's so important?
So Rangjung Dorje was the third Kamapa. And he lived in the late 13th, early 14th century. And he was born really poor. His family had no resources, not even any land. And he was recognized as the reincarnation of the second Kamapa by the Siddha, the person who was renowned as the Siddha or Gempa, who took him under his wing. And then there was a war, and he moved to Tsurpu Monastery, the home of the second Kamapa. And even though the people at Tsurpu weren't really happy about it, he stayed there for quite a while. And gradually through his lifetime, through his writing and his teaching and his traveling and his, I guess, personal charisma, he slowly became recognized as recognized and accepted as the reincarnation of the second Kamapa. And so what you have with Rangjung Dorje is he's the first child to be recognized as a reincarnate, and he's the first third in a row, if that makes sense. So there had been people before him, quite a few people before him who'd said that they were the reincarnation or emanation or manifestation of another being, but most of the time this had only happened once, right? So they'd say, I'm a manifestation of this person, I'm an incarnation of that person, but there hadn't been a line, and you kind of need three in a line for it to become a line. So his recognition as a child was the first time you had like a line of reincarnates in Tibetan Buddhism. And then so he has no background, no family, and his whole identity is to be a reincarnation. So most of his writing, or a lot of his writing, reflects how he's establishing and coming to understand and promoting that identity.
He becomes involved in politics and things, right, later in his life.
He becomes involved in... Well, I think he's actually born involved in politics, the poor guy. He's also a really prolific writer, really, smart person who keeps writing works of philosophy and works of about medicine. He's like something of a polymath, and that helps to consolidate his reputation as well. And he happens to live this. I don't know, you wouldn't say rags to riches, but maybe like, because he's supposed to be wearing rags all the time as a monk, but from obscurity to prominence, he lives this obscure to prominent life during the last stage of the Mongol Empire. And towards the end of his life, he's invited to the Mongol court, where he becomes the last emperor of the Mongol Empire, Dogen Timur's primary guru or primary teacher. So he goes from being a kid from a vagrant family on the edges of the Mongol Empire in southern Tibet to the fabled city. He dies in the fabled city of Xanadu or Shangdu in Inner Mongolia, what is now Inner Mongolia. Yeah. And the whole period is there's politics, politics, politics that he has to deal with. I mean, his first trip to Serpu basically seems to come about because there's a war on where he grew up between two sets of Mongol troops, and he basically goes there as a refugee. Yeah, so yeah. Politics the whole way through.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing story, and the second half of your book really kind of draws a lot on these autobiographical writings and songs and outlines Rangjung Dorje's life. I'm wondering, the first half of your book focuses a little bit more on the historical context of Rangjung Dorje and explains more about how the Buddhist theory of rebirth gave way to the Tibetan Tulku tradition, which is uniquely Tibetan and which you call in your book an invented tradition. I'm wondering if you could explain a little bit by what you mean when you say that the Tulku tradition is an invented tradition.
Well, it's taking this idea from Hobsworth in the English literature tradition, who basically says that all traditions are invented. You know, they're not organic. They don't grow up naturally. They kind of, people invest in them and create them as they go along. And I think that this is what happens with traditions, is that we lose the invention and accept them as being a normal part of life. And what I was looking at in this book is how the idea of a reincarnation tradition and a reincarnation institutions and the belief structures associated with them are often placed back onto the earlier tradition, the earlier parts of the tradition when it was being invented, when they weren't there at the time. So it wasn't a given that Rangjung Dorje would be recognized as a Karmapa. It wasn't a given that the tradition would continue. It was the idea of it being continuous and that it would keep going was something of an invention of his writing and his perception of the world. His understanding of himself more than just the world. So there was kind of a feedback loop between how he understood himself, how the world saw him, and that created a sense that the Karmapas would be there. And then so after he dies, it seemed natural for people to go and find his rebirth. So it's kind of invented it through the course of his life.
Okay. So, yeah, I like this idea of this kind of feedback loop. I'm wondering, could you give an example or something of some way that this feedback loop kind of works? Like, how did Rangjung Dorje work to create this kind of persona where people would go and look for his reincarnation after he died?
So I guess in some ways that the whole of the first section of the book is about feedback loops. So I've got this idea of feedback loops through stories. Like, he tells a story. And the quote that I had in the front of the book, which I really loved, was he has this thing where he says, "The time when I was young is like a dream, but I will speak a little of the parts that are clear, because it's like it was someone else's story, and if I tell it, it will make it another person's story." So yeah. He's inventing him. It's very meta for the 13th century or the 14th century. He's acknowledging his own invention in the telling of his story. So it's as if he tells his story, then that becomes his identity, and that identity is the basis on which he tells the story. So there's a feedback loop there, an identity, a narrative feedback loop. I am my story, and my story is how I understand myself, right? Mm-hmm. But then I also think that works with his identity in lineages. I am part of this lineage, and then the lineage defines me, right? So that's another one. And also through communities, like, lineages aren't just often when people describe things, they hollow out the idea of a lineage to the people who are like the lineage holders or the centers of it. But there's actually a lot of community support that needs to go into the preservation of any tradition. And so there's like a relational loop between the Kamapas and those that support them over the years as well. And the other thing that I'm really, really interested in is how that is in place. So how the idea of the idea of the Kamapas, the idea of reincarnation lineage is very much a product of a place as well as a time. And so the Kamapa, the third Kamapa, Ramchand Dorje, spends a lot of time invests a lot of ink. Even he says that I'm using a lot of ink to emplace the Kamapas in situations like in Serpil Monastery and their other and sacred sites and retreat centers. And he sets up the situation whereby his presence in these places sacralizes them and their sacrality sacralizes him. That makes sense. So he makes them sacred by being there, and they make him sacred through their sacredness. It becomes another feedback loop. So they're happening all over the place. It's all kind of relational. The idea of being a tukru is very much, or a reincarnate, is very much a relational identity and how do I put it? It's something that you work at, but something that people become aware of, and then they help solidify that identity as well. I think there was one about the I'm trying to find the quote, but there was one he actually says he does the same kind of meta analysis of literature that transforms landscapes into sacred sites as he does about himself. And he says something like, I can praise this site and the praise makes it sacred, and then the sacred makes the praise sacred, and it goes round in circles. Yeah. So
yeah, these feedback loops are really interesting, thinking about he's writing kind of intentionally and saying, okay, this is who I am. And then, you know, that kind of reinforces the idea of who he is, and, these feedback loops with communities. And then I think the stuff that you're doing with space is really interesting too. I mean, as you just mentioned, you know, you're focusing not just on time and the idea of, you know, reincarnation lineages, but you're also talking about space and not just physical space, but also sacred space.
Yeah.
And I think thinking of it in terms of a feedback loop is really, really interesting. I'm curious. I mean, you've already said a little bit, but I'm wondering if you could expand more on this idea of space and how did that become so important in this project?
Just before I do that, I found the quote.
Great.
This will then become a site where reciprocal praise is performed between the sacred site itself and the actors who praise it repeatedly. For wherever there is praise, there is repetitive reciprocity. Wherever there is praise, it is repeated. All right,
that's
so
great.
I mean, that was one of the things I liked about him so much. He seems so. I think that the third Kamapa would have made a really good marketer. Or like it worked really well in advertising, you know, or I mean, hopefully for, you know, good causes like, you know, the environment or whatever. But he's really kind of aware of this personal creation and the way that words can be used to create identities and constructions of how people understand things in his own writing. It's fascinating. I find it fascinating. But the idea of space was the main reason that I became interested in it. It was such a theme in the song, in his collection of songs, or good, these spontaneous songs that were part of, that are really predominant in the Gamagagyu, but, you know, a lot of yogi traditions in Tibet. And because they're created in a situation, usually a kind of a tantric ritual or feast, they reflect a lot on where they're being created. So they describe where he is. They use the environment as kind of metaphors for trying to get to higher truth or whatever it is. They're a really predominant theme. And it struck me when I was reading them that in some ways that the poems are like the descriptors and the spatial aspect of his story. So the idea of space, I got the idea of focusing on the space and the environment in which he was operating by the songs, his songs of experience, which are part of the yogi traditions of Tibet, that the yogis would sing songs, usually extemporaneously, and because they were singing them spontaneously in an environment, they would usually use that environment as metaphors or reflect on it when they were singing. So the idea of the environment and the place he's in becomes a dominant theme throughout all of his songs. And so that made me think about how we understand space in history, because we tend to have more about this happened, then this happened, then this happened, rather than the space in which it happened. And it struck me that the songs told us about space, and the life stories, the Namtha, they focus on time. So they say this happened, then this happened, then this time happened. And they only have like a really brief descriptions of the environment. So he say, I went to Lhasa, and then this and this and this and this and this happened. You don't get a description of Lhasa in most Tibetan biography. But the songs, on the other hand, have this big descriptions of place. And I was thinking that one of the most popular of these biography tradition, Milarepa's songs, they actually have both. The narrative is interrupted by songs where he reflects on where he is. So you get this time-space flicking between the two throughout that narrative. And so what I had in the text that I was working with was, in Rangchen Dorje's text, was all space in the song and then all temporality in the life stories. And so the distinction between the two of them was really stark, whereas it may not have been if they'd been blended together.
Okay, yeah. So you were kind of blending things together, almost creating a biography of Rangchen Dorje in a way similar to what you see in Milarepa's
I don't think I've
writings.
Done that yet. I'm going to do that because this is much more kind of analyzing those texts, but I think that's something
sure.
that needs to be done. But yeah, I'm wondering about the hubris of, you know, I'm writing your autobiography, you know what I mean?
Well, sure,
But in the analysis, I was working between the two to try and get a picture of the world that he inhabited.
Sure, sure. And this, I mean, I think focusing on time and space together, it makes for a much more rich sort of story and rich presentation of Rangchen Dorje's life. And you're able to kind of get, as a reader, you're able to get a better understanding and a deeper understanding of not just what was happening, but what was happening and where.
Yeah, I think maybe this comes from snowboarding. Right, because before I was a snowboarder, I was a skateboarder, right? And you have this thing of everywhere you walk, you're seeing different paths to take, and you know,
right? You have to find your line, right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
so you're always looking at the environment, trying to see paths down it and how you can get around it, and I think that I'm too kind of broken to keep. Well, not snowboarding. I'm not broken enough to stop snowboarding. It means that you have this kind of spatial awareness that I think came through in the reading the literature. I'm trying to figure out how he's getting around places and everything almost instinctively, as opposed to just having this idea of this happened there and this happened and there. I think I'm always kind of asking where things happened as well as when and how. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so see your whole path to becoming a scholar, it's all connected.
Yeah, yeah, it's connected. And that idea, if you start doing path metaphors, it never ends. There's always.
Yeah, that's true. Well, that's great. So I'm curious, you know, because the Tulku tradition, which, you know, arose in Tibetan Buddhism after Rangchen Dorje, You know, this idea of reincarnation kind of developed into the Tulku tradition. But because that's so deeply ingrained in contemporary Tibetan Buddhism, I'm just kind of curious. I mean, I could imagine that some of the claims that you're making in this book about it being an invented tradition and about Rangjung Dorje being intentional in writing his autobiographies in this way, was that controversial in any way? Have you received any kind of pushback from, you know, from Tibetan people against some of the claims that you're making in this book?
Not yet. but I don't actually know if I am contradicting I'm contradicting the kind of shortened narrative, right? So what I see happening through the retellings of Rangjung Dorje's story is this kind of short form of his and the other Karmapa's lives, so that they're reduced into being kind of photocopies of each other. And that always struck me about when they have the Tangka lineages up on the wall. So they have like one and the next and the next and the next, and the actual individual lived experience is kind of a bit lost. And it strikes me, you know, not just from a historian's perspective, but as someone who's interested in how beings lived, that there's something very reductive about that. What's the point of people, even if you're looking at it from a Buddhist perspective, what's the point of being an embodied person who, if you take this perspective that he had insights or realizations or whatever, the idea that he came down as an embodied being. I mean, that's what his story says. He took life he chose to be born in order to help. So therefore that lived experience is supposed to be a demonstration to other people on how to live. So to ignore that, ignore the kind of effort and the way that he used the opportunities he had in order to, you know, negotiate through a complicated situation with trying to keep the intention to help all beings in his head, I think getting rid of that is actually more insulting. You know, reducing that to a single image is actually more insulting than paying respect to it or engaging with that lifetime in a more in-depth way. But I mean, that's personally, I think it's kind of to dismiss it as being just part of a tradition or another step, as opposed to thinking about the complicated choices and the moral judgments and the sacrifices that had to be made by embodied beings, it seems more respectful than just putting the people in a line and reducing them to a photocopy.
Well, that makes sense.
I haven't been criticized yet, but I've got a reply for when it happens.
Well, that's good. It's good to be prepared. Yeah. So, I mean, thinking about the past and just thinking, I don't know, about the Tulku tradition more broadly and looking toward the future. You know, I don't know, just thinking about contemporary developments, things we're hearing in the news about certain Buddhist teachers, including Tibetan teachers who are recognized as tulkus, right, who have been accused of using their status to abuse or manipulate their students. You know, given all of this, given the current environment around this, do you think that the Tulku tradition can survive?
I think it will. I think the question is more like whether it should in its current form. And I mean, there's things to it. I mean, that's what I find interesting about the story of Rangjung Dorje. Another thing about I found in his writing was that he's doing something quite radical, right? He's a lowborn, landless, not deserving of an education in a worldly sense person who has this idea that through this kind of gift of being recognized and the kindness that his teachers showed him, that he has a whole world opens up to him that would never have opened up to anyone else in his situation. So in some ways, at that stage early on, it was a very kind of egalitarian. I keep having this idea in my head that Ranjan Dorji may have had a sister who was really good at piano playing, right? But she was never, the causes and conditions were never there for her to have the same life as him, right? Mm. So that's kind of like a alternative history. But for him, this idea of being recognized and having gave him access to opportunities and, you know, spiritual opportunities as well as travel opportunities, educational opportunities that he would never have had. So in some ways at that stage, it was shaking up society. It was a radical transformation of, for at least for him, a radical transformation of how power structures were working at that point, right? And since mm-hmm. then, it was also an affront to embedded hierarchies in families, because the tulku is a familyless lineage, if that makes sense. So it was an affront to embedded power structures of his time. And I don't see that happening now. I see a certain sense of entitlement, right? So that is not a certain sense of entitlement. You're seeing some extreme entitlement. And even I actually think that the tulku system is even really kind of harmful to the good guys in a way, you know, the ones that kind of are recognized as children and are trying to do the right thing. Like I remember I used to work as an interpreter while I was at graduate school and doing it as well. And I remember one ring tulku saying to me, he'd had to go and deal with someone who was being really dodgy. You say dodgy in America?
Yeah.
Okay. And he was saying, I have to go and contain this situation because he does one thing and negative, it reflects on all of us.
Mm.
Right? So it's like a communal reputational thing as well as individually. And I remember thinking that he was trying to do the right thing, but this whole system was imprisoning him as well. And it's kind of – it's a strange situation because on the one hand you get all of this – it gives you privilege. And for some people that becomes like a burden of responsibility. And for other people, which is not easy. And on the other hand, for other people it seems to become a license to be obnoxious, at least, if not abusive. So mm-hmm. I think in both ways it's a burden. And I even heard a story once, someone told me, I can't say who, but someone told me that they had been, the local monks had come and said that they were a tulku, and their father had said, no, you're child thieves. You're not taking my son. And away. And I was like, wow, they said that to the monastery? And he said, yeah, because there was this idea that even if you have special qualities, that being in that situation isn't necessarily the best way for them to come to the fore. Which I just found fascinating. And that kind of speaks to some of something else about it, and I'm ranting on here, apologies, is that...
No, it's all right.
As an interpreter, I think some of what we're seeing in these abusive situations is a misreading of how the tulku system worked within Tibet, right? So there was a lot more restrictions on their behavior than there is in the West. And in some ways, mm-hmm. they actually remind me of like drunk Australians in Bali, or I'm guessing drunk Americans in Mexico. In that they've gone into a situation where their like power and wealth and status enables them to do things, but there's not the social restrictions on that behavior. Right. So if you did this in Tibet, someone would lock you up. Right. And you wouldn't have access to the same people that you would in these situations. You know, it's I gave a talk once because I've had this strange situation. I've interpreted for about 7 different tulkus and lamas and geshis and so on. And 6 of them gave me instructions on how to deal with sleazy teachers.
Wow.
Right? Yeah, sick.
Wow.
And the other one was just so kind of otherworldly that it was, you know, he wasn't really on our plane. it wasn't something that I've been invested in. But all of them were saying, you know, in Tibet, if you wouldn't be in a vulnerable situation like you are as an interpreter, you would have your family, you would have lots of protection, the relationships between people are negotiated much more, but you're very isolated. So you need to, and they gave me like, I can't remember them off the top of my head, but they told me sutras to quote and lines to use if someone said that, you know, that they're awakened and we should have tantric sex. And I was supposed to say, well, you may be awakened, but I know I'm not.
Wow.
I'll be breaking my vows. And so there was this whole, they all told me stories that I could tell to protect myself. And so I was thinking about it, is what we're dealing with here is, as the Tulku tradition developed, there was lots of corruption, there was wars, there was all sorts of things went on, but there was also social structures that developed in order to contain that privilege. And what mm-hmm. we're dealing with is situations where that privilege isn't contained.
Yeah, I mean, it's as Tibetan Buddhism is expanding outside of Tibet, it's encountering these wildly different social structures and situations.
Yeah, and it's and for the people that don't know how to negotiate that, that don't have any background in it, that don't have any like family networks of, you know, I don't know, some thuggish uncle that's just not going to put up with that, then there's you're in a very vulnerable situation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, yeah, and I don't know. Is it? It's also really. I'm not saying this as just me who's looked at this tradition. I'm also taking a lot of these cues from people who've lived it. Like the Dalai mm-hmm. Lama says, there is too many tulku. They're like, you know, weeds. They're growing up everywhere. That's probably not a bad good analogy. They're spreading everywhere. There's so many. And traditionally there was much less resources to support that level of tukuness, for want of a better word. So that's one issue. And the other issue is that it's a very different world, and it means that, you know, keeping people in a situation where their life choices are decided at age 3 is very intensely problematic. And then they're also, you know, there's all things about them being like not just as abusers, but as abused and things as well. So it's very different from what I'm looking at historically, what I looked at historically. It's a very different.
Yeah, it's a very different situation than the situation that Rongchen Dorje grew up in.
Yeah. And at that stage, I mean, it wasn't completely radical, but it was a break. It was a development that loosens society as opposed to tightening patriarchy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was thinking about authority in a totally radical way.
Yeah. And there was also these weird parallel authorities. Like the thing that strikes me about looking, I've been working on writing an article about the history of all the Karmapas. And the thing that I looked at with all of their histories is that they didn't actually really take over control of Turku until after the war with the fifth Dalai Lama and the Uyun Sang war in the 1600s.
Oh, okay.
So until that point, they were kind of associated with Turku, but moving around. And there was the second Karmapa's family was still in charge, basically. So there was a parallel authority to worldly, to familial authority.
So it
creates like a break in power structures as opposed to, or alternative power structures as opposed to enforcing power structures that can then be abused.
So one last question for you, just because we're almost out of time. What are you working on now? What's next for you?
I found a poem in the Third Karmapa's work, which was about a famine. And he describes a famine that was so intense that there was cannibalism, and blames the famine on the troops that have come in and destroyed the soil. And this really struck me. I was like, that's insane.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, really intense, really descriptive and very material. And that's led me off on this whole other thing about looking at the materiality of the history as well as the space. So I've been transforming myself into an environmental historian after being inspired by Zhang Zhundoji. And I'm currently writing a environmental history of the Yalun Sanpo River.
Okay.
And looking at the impacts that humans have had on it and its a role in shaping the human communities in Tibet. And I'm actually using his poems and descriptions as well as other people's poems and descriptions of the river and everything from Dunhuang documents to pollen samples to tracking the dams on the river and so on. So like a long history of the Yalun Sanpo from when it was formed by the two continents smashing into each other up until today when it's being dammed. That's my current project.
Wow. So like a biography of the river.
Yeah. Literally a biography of the river, like how it's graphing its biology.
Yeah. Wow. That's great. That's fascinating.
So it's, yeah. And some of that is also how people understand the river, what they believe about the river, how they conceptualize it and how its presence is used as a metaphor in religious writing and spiritual understanding and that sort of thing too. So yeah,
wow.
That's my current project. It's a bit of a departure, but I went from snowboarding to being a Tibetan interpreter. So
so maybe this is a little more closely related. But it seems like it's all connected. Now I'm always going to think about Rangjung Dorje as a snowboarder, snowboarding through Tibet. So.
I actually once went from snowboarding to live in India. I was had a chat to a guy called Amten, Dogden Amten, who'd been amazing meditator his whole life. And he said, I had to explain snowboarding to him. And then I got to the end of describing it in Tibetan with the snow and everything. And then he said, why? And then he's like, get back to me when you can do it without a board. So.
Oh, that's great.
So I think maybe, yeah, Rangjung Dorje could do some stuff without a board that I can't.
That's probably true.
Or could do. Yeah.
Well, Ruth, it was really great talking to you today, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk about your book.
No, thank you. That was great fun.
That was Ruth Gamble, author of Reincarnation in Tibetan Buddhism, The Third Karmapa and the Invention of a Tradition, published by Oxford University Press in 2018. You can find out about more new books in Buddhist studies and other subjects by visiting newbooksnetwork.com or by searching for New Books Network wherever you get your podcasts.